Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
The Jam, Paul Weller, Bruce Foxton, and Rick Buckler were the ultimate angry young men of pop. leading the mod revival of the 70s in thrilling new directions. Their tight live shows, razor-sharp style, and perfectly crafted image, crafted songs earned them a devoted number of a devoted following and a string of huge hits. In 1982, the Jam were at the top of their game. There was a huge tour coming out. They were just finishing work on the new album, The Gift. And it was the year that defined and suddenly sort of exploded into music history. It's the subject of a book called The Jam 1982. It's written by Rick Buckler and Zoe Howe. Delighted to be joining me live on the line, drummer of The Jam, Rick Buckley. Rick, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm very well. You know, another day in southern Spain. It could be worse. Where do we find you on God's green earth today?
Oh, shivering in cold Woking. That's where we are.
Shivering in Woking should be should be an independent band, I think. It'd be a great name for a band, Shivering in Woking. It should be a Reading festival. It's 40 years. What happened, Rick?
Well, yeah, exactly. Whoosh, what was all that? It was a bit of a difficult book to go back to revisit that year, 1982, obviously 40 years ago, because it started off really well, as you can imagine. We just finished our new album, which was The Gift at the time, and we were looking forward to the whole thing sort of unraveling the year and touring, etc. And then obviously, Paul sort of landed the bombshell that he wanted to leave the band, which was really out of the blue, absolutely nobody expected that. So it was always a bit of an unexplained mystery, really.
Mm. And it wasn't as if you'd been having these huge sort of Led Zeppelin style, I'll be in my trailer, you'll be in yours, because that wasn't what The Jam was about, was it? It was the anti that sort of band. I mean, that was the whole point of what you guys were doing.
Well, yes. I mean, that's right. I mean, we got on really well. We were obviously selling tickets and selling records and, the sort of peak, I suppose. No sort of reason actually seemed to fit. I mean, it was very bemusing to hear that Paul saying that he thought he was on a treadmill. That was the reason he gave us for leaving the band, and he wanted to simply get off of the treadmill. That didn't make a lot of sense. I mean, not all the things that I think Paul has said over the years, he keeps changing his mind as to why he left the band, but I think it was probably to do with the way that the band was run. I think he felt maybe that the pressure and the control just wasn't there for him.
I mean, we always hear that story about, the bands aren't sort of prepared for the way that the suddenly a single will catch light and take off. With The Jam, I mean, presumably you've been playing for a while. It wasn't a case of you got together, you released A-Bomb on Water Street and you were off. I mean, what was the, you've been doing this for a while.
Yeah, we did. We'd myself and Paul had got together basically 10 years prior to that. We'd done all the usual things, worked our way through the clubs around the south of England, moved into London, made a success of playing the London pub rock scene as it was then, and got spotted by the record company. And then, obviously, we loved playing live, so we really threw ourselves at it. We took on loads and loads of work, as much as we could possibly take. We did two albums in 1977 in one year, which was sort of unheard of. I just really loved it and worked and worked and worked really hard to try and sort of, establish ourselves within the music industry and, with our fans. So after all that work, it just seemed like it was being sort of thrown away, really.
Yeah, and it wasn't a case of it being a fad. It wasn't a case that you'd leapt on the sort of Scar two-tone sort of special selector. That aspect of New Wave was coming along. Because you had this, formidable with Bruce Foxton on bass, but a brilliant bass player. I mean, you had this power. I mean, it sounds a bit silly now, but you had this power trio, and it was all equals, rather than some other power trios where, perhaps one is a higher than the other, or the drummers taking over everything, but it was stripped down and extremely, I'll use it again, powerful, effective.
Well, it was. I think, Paul's great strength was his songwriting and his lyrics. And Bruce, although he joined us as a rhythm guitarist, he went over to bass, which was actually an advantage because he plays bass like a rhythm guitarist. So that's just exactly what we needed. You know, I think myself and him worked really well together to sort of, you know, for all the rhythm section and to put songs together and what have you. I think as a three-piece, I think we were very strong. You know, I think we had all the right elements. I think it was just one of those sort of combinations that seemed to work really, really well.
So it's 1982, and the thing I like about the book is it sets it in context, because this is one of the sayings that I always say: nothing acts without a vacuum. Nothing exists in a vacuum is what I normally say, and we tend to forget, because there's all this. People tend to think the 80s was all mobile phones, red braces, and people making loads of money, but it's a period at the beginning, you know, of the Falklands War. We got unrest with the unions, etc. And this was a catalyst. This was something that was going on with the music, and you know, you were a working class band.
Yes, we were. I mean, I think Paul was very good as an observer, which obviously, you know, reflected, came out in the lyrics of what we saw going on around us, and I think people related to us because of that, and because of our sort of strong relationship with our fans. We used to let them into the sound checks, and we'd always meet with them and etc. I think that sort of bond was well appreciated from the fans. You know, there was no sort of us and them. So we had a great following, and we belonged to them and they belonged to us, and you know, it was very sort of honest in that respect.
And did, I mean, by 82, you know, you're on top of the pops as a regular thing. Your albums are going up to coming in, or singles coming in straight at the number one. Did you sort of feel that perhaps it was becoming a bit too poppy? Were people saying these are the next, because that was the thing that people always said, these are the next Beatles, it was going to have Jam mania, you know, the Jam versus the Police, the other three, you know, the other threesome, if you like, of the time. I mean, was it becoming a bit too poppy? Were you just getting on with your stuff and letting the critics say what they are want to say?
Well, we weren't too much swayed by the critics, really. I mean, there were pressures from the record company to try and get the numbers up, to try and sell more singles and et cetera, all that sort of thing. But, I mean, I think, you know, we did what we felt was we were comfortable doing. I think that's why we managed to sort of gain our own sort of credibility in that respect. I don't think we were too poppy. I mean, we weren't sort of selling our souls we never did a Christmas record. We never did all that sort of thing.
I'm just imagining the Jam's Christmas record, you know. I can see it now, yeah.
Well, I think we would have hated that. I think we, you know, because that would have really have been pampering to the market and to the media. But anyway, yeah, we never did anything like that. And I think we kept our feet on the ground as far as most of that sort of stuff was concerned.
How do you transfer the sort of the live energy? Because the Jam's gigs were you know, famous for their live energy, three piece again. How do you translate that to a studio sound? Was it basically you were trying to do the same stuff in the studio that you were doing live, or was it taking more time? I mean, how did you approach that?
We did approach it exactly the same way. I mean, we recorded pretty much everything in the studio as much as possible, as live as we possibly could. So most of the backing tracks were done live, and then there was obviously, you know, things like the vocals might have been done again, or, you know, the odd bits of tinkering, but not. We didn't really want to produce the hell out of things so that it lost that life, you know. We very much used to playing live, and that's the way that we approached the studio in pretty much the same way.
And people always go about images being manufactured and carefully tinkered and focus groups and that whole thing. And you look at the pictures of the Jam, and I mean, the live shots again, you know, with, you know, either Weller or Foxen halfway to the stratosphere, leaping around the place, and you know, laying down some drum licks. But there wasn't, you know, was it just the way you dressed, and that was just the style it was, and it wasn't, you didn't have stylists, you didn't have advisors on the image.
No. I mean, I think we were quite natural. What we felt, you know, fitted and you know, into what we wanted. I mean, we always wanted our own, you know, visual identity as well as our own musical identity. And, you know, so we, because in the early days, you can imagine that the punk thing came along and everybody wanted to sort of jump on that particular bandwagon, whereas we didn't sort of play on that too much. Although we were playing the same clubs and, playing probably much of the same audiences, I think we still sort of wanted our own identity. So, it wasn't too manufactured, really. I mean, it was... I think it just felt like the way we looked and the way that we sounded sort of, were quite closely linked.
And that connection with the audience? Because, as I said before, this was a band that played to the audience. The audience got... people still talk about the Jam in hushed tones. The audience really got the Jam in a way that very few bands have before or since.
Yeah, we'd spent 5 years going around clubs, and we'd sort of learnt our stagecraft in that respect. And I mean, one thing that we wanted, people bought tickets to come to listen to the music, so there wasn't a lot of talking between songs. There wasn't a lot of razzmatazz, around what we were doing. Basically, it's just going out there and playing live. So the set was, once it was like light the blue touch paper, and that was it. The set would just barrel through right the way to the end, and I think in that respect, it kept the excitement up all the way through the evening. I know that I don't really, it's odd, but you don't really remember the gigs. It was like they start and then all of a sudden you're off stage, it was that intense.
And, was it, because people will say, oh, it was a crazy time, man, and I've, read a couple of, because we tend to forget as well, sort of the power that things like Sounds, NME, Melody Maker had at the time, and they would send journalists out to cover, the concerts, and that could make or break a band as well. But was it fun? I mean, were you having a lot? Because people would say, oh, well, I wasn't really happy, towards the end of it. But presumably, 82, you were still enjoying yourselves.
Well, we were, yeah. I mean, the shows, especially in 1982, were probably the best that we'd ever done. We hadn't really finished improving, It's, all the albums are distinctly different from the previous one. I mean, we moved on musically, and we were obviously trying out lots of different avenues and what have you. So we still had plenty in us, I think, that left to explore. I don't think we'd ever became boring or short of ideas on where we wanted to go. I think sometimes the pressure put on us by the record company about, like, we need another single, we need another album, so therefore you need another tour and blah 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 blah, and it just carries on, it snowballs. I think sometimes that maybe got started to get to us, and I think that might have been one reason why Paul just probably felt that a bit of a knee-jerk reaction, that he just completely lost control. But, I mean, your life's not your own when you're in a band. Anybody will tell you that. Anybody that's in a professional band, you will know that you have to hand over the next 6 months of your life at least to organise up-and-coming shows and tours and recording schedules and what have you. We absolutely loved it, but, it was pretty much full-on from the moment we got signed, and there was nobody really in control to actually turn around and say, well, right, we can actually take a break if we want to now. We can start calling some of the shots. So that was a bit of a shame, that because we were pretty much managed by the record company. They sort of, their agenda was sell more records. So it was, the more work we were offered, we just accepted it and did it.
And so one day, Paul Weller just, did he sort of, call you up? Did you have a chat about it? I mean, was it? Did you find out? I was going to say we couldn't find out on social media, but was there an article in Melody Maker? I mean, what was your thoughts?
No, I mean, we managed to squeeze a holiday in. We put about a week to 10 days aside for each of us to go off and have a break, and then when we were coming back, we were straight back into a recording studio again, and it was at that point that Paul decided that he was going to tell us that he was he'd had enough and he wanted to leave the band, and that was that. I mean, there's people who say in the book that who we interviewed, who said they knew it was coming. I mean, it's all right looking back 40 years and saying this, but at the time, nobody actually saw it coming whatsoever. It just was completely out of the blue. The book sort of tries to cover all those angles, what people think about it after 40 years of mulling over these stories, you know, it's like you come back and you've caught this fish and it's 3 inches long. And the more you tell the story, the fish gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So there was a lot of that, I think, in it, which you sort of expect, because obviously it's full of interviews from different people who were there back in the day. But, you know, from my point of view, from the insider's point of view, it was a real surprise that what Paul did. I mean, even his own father, even John, you know, who was sort of had the title of managing us, he was totally gutted because, you know, to him, we were his baby. We were his project, if you like. And even he didn't know what was going on. So it just seemed like it was one of them sort of stubborn decisions that Paul made, and he just will not go back on it. And he's never really given a satisfactory answer as to why he did it in the first place.
So you still had commitments to make. You still had, and then there was, I remember, because, you know, I was a young man as well at the time, and there was this whole build-up to, you know, the last album, the last single, you know, Beat Surrender coming out, that last appearance on Top of the Pops. So that must have been through gritted teeth.
Well, not too much. I mean, we all respected Paul's decision to leave. That was, you know, we know we were old enough and mature enough to understand nothing lasts forever. So what we did was we just worked out a plan of how we were going to go about and do it. We had still one album to give to the record company, which was turned out to be a live album. That sorted that problem out. We sorted out the last few shows that we were already committed to contractually, and you know, and quite in a very gentlemanly fashion, we went about putting the whole, you know, the whole thing to bed, as it were. So, you know, and like I say, the shows were really good. I mean, I think personally speaking, I always felt that Paul would change his mind once he saw, you know, what the band had obviously meant to our fans for the years we were around, and the shows were really good, and you know, what was he was actually sort of, well, you mean effectively throwing away. He might change his mind, but he obviously didn't. So yeah, I think we acted in a very professional manner to, you know, to respect his view. I mean, if that's what he wanted to do, and he couldn't, nobody could change his mind, then that's the way it was. So it's just a shame. I just think one thing I think we didn't need was sort of these vague answers as to why he did it, really.
And you think of what the project did is, you know, sort of after that, sort of all that sort of cafe society style, you know, style council, etc., which, you know, I'm not a huge fan of because I like my music pretty raw. But anyway, let's go there. But let's go back to this book then, because which I am holding, as you can probably hear in the background, that in my hot little hands, 40, you know, revisiting it and speaking with the lovely Zoe Howe, who I've had the pleasure of interviewing on this show several times. And if you're going to do a book with somebody, then Zoe is obviously the person to do it with. And looking at the people you've interviewed, including, you know, Gary Crowley, etc. I mean, this is if you knew these figures around, it's great to have their ideas, and B, to have these fabulous photographs and these bits of memorabilia in there as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think the photographs are great. I mean, they add so much more to the story, because Twink, who took a lot of those photographs, was actually on the road with us. So there's a lot of sort of candid shots in the background, and, you know, not the normal sort of press shots that people have mostly seen. So there's a few unseen things in there as well, and I think the photographs really make it. Overall, I'm quite pleased with the way it's all turned out. I mean, Zoe was a great help, and she did, you know, her part really well, I think.
Yeah, and also there's things like, you know, it's like it is that the North America tour and the Japan tour, and it's like it is that sort of, you know, what could have been. But then again, you know, I think, you know, had the Jam gone for the whole long, you know, big hair and big shoulder pads, I mean, that could have been an awful legacy, because it does say, doesn't it? It says the end of an era, the start of a legacy. Well, you know, thanks for that. But people, as I said before, you have, with the Jam, one of the most influential bands of the past 50 years. People say, oh, Oasis, oh, it was the Beatles, but they borrow an awful lot from your playbook as well. And every three piece ever since. So, you know, that must give you do you look back and go, that, you know, that was a time, and it's allowed me to kind of do what I want to do at the moment.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, everything that happened to all three of us really was all because of the Jam. I mean, the Jam put us where, you know. Personally speaking, I'm very proud of everything that we did there, because I think we worked very hard to do it and to achieve that success. Because you can imagine that the music industry is not the easiest of businesses to get into, and sure. There's all sorts of pitfalls that people can, you know, trip over. There's all sorts of things that you know, that can get in the way, and you know, fame, money, greed, all sorts of things. So up to a point, I think we managed to survive most of those. But yeah, I mean, it's just lovely. It's almost impossible to appreciate from an insider's point of view what influence we've you know, subsequently had on people. But I do hear it a lot from fans when I go and do Q&As, or people email me and what have you. So I just think that's fantastic. We've left more behind than something which was just for ourselves.
Yeah, and I was going to say, you know, you did live tours with the Jam, a book tour. What's that like?
I do quite a lot of those. I mean, I find them quite interesting, and people have got questions that they want answered after all these years, and you know, they want to hear the inside story of this, that, and the other, and it's, it's just a way of sort of getting back in contact with people who had either been to see us back in the day or hadn't, and they wanted to find out more about, you know, the band itself. So, and they're usually quite, you know, good humoured affairs. So, I mean, I'm just off to do some more. I'm going up to Blackpool and Dundee and Glasgow and a few other places, and I've got some more planned for next year as well. So, I mean, no doubt the book might throw up a few more questions, but that's all good. So, yeah, I enjoy them.
It is a fabulous book. The book is called The Jam 1982. It's by Rick Buckler and written with the lovely Zoe Howe. It's got some absolutely gorgeous photographs. You'll be able to order it and download it from our own virtual bookstore. And as you said, I told you off air, but you talk about people saying they're influencers and fans. And as I said before, the first single that I ever bought from a record store as a 45 was the double A side, A Boy and Wardle Street and David Watts. So that's my fanboy bit done, Rick.
Well, we couldn't have done it without people buying the records, so thank you very much.
The pleasure was indeed mine. If people want to find out what you're up to, you know, these days, you got a website, you do social media, where can people track you down in the nicest possible way?
Well, I've got Instagram, which is RickBuckler2022. I do have thejamfan.net and an online shop for merchandising and books and what have you, which is strangetown.net as well. Ooh, so there's plenty out there to find out stuff about what's going on currently.
And if you had to pick a high watermark, a bit where you looked around and went, this is absolutely why I'm doing this. It can be from any point, you know, from 2022 down to 1962, if you want to. But what would you say it was?
The fondest memories I think I have is when you walk out on the stage and you see a whole crowd of people. It doesn't matter whether it's a small venue or a very large venue, and you know they're all there for the band, you know. And I think that's absolutely fantastic, because they're obviously into, you know, the same thing that you are, and that's just wonderful, because everybody's on the same page and singing from the same hymn sheet, as it were. So yeah, that's I think the high point really.
The book is called The Jam 1982. It's by Rick Buckler with Zoe Howe. Rick, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Okay, thanks very much for talking to us.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.